This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here today with Utsav Sangani of Synopsys.
Hi, everyone. My name is Utsav Sangani, and I'm a senior product manager on the Synopsys team. Synopsys is a very broad organization. We span from chip design to application security. We have some of the best application security tools in our portfolio, ranging from Coverity, Black Duck, Seeker, as some prominent names. I work across Coverity and Black Duck, so I'm very familiar with the static analysis space and the software composition analysis space. I've been in the DevOps business for over 4 years now. I've been actively advocating use of DevOps, making sure that application security can very conveniently embed itself into a DevOps process. That's my background.
For way over a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, we've been talking about the need for security to understand a little bit more about what goes on in the software development process. For at least the last 2 years, everybody's been shouting DevSecOps. Why are we still at the point where people seem to have no clue what DevSecOps is?
That's an interesting question, Ian. Actually, that's also valid because I think people are still trying to understand what DevOps means for their organization, because each organization has a different perspective. Their development agility levels are different. So if something makes sense for organization A, does not necessarily mean it makes sense for organization B. And as application security experts in the market, we have to understand and make sure that our product fits into that DevOps process. If you're running with speed velocity V at this organization versus V squared, let's say it's going double the time on the second organization, it doesn't mean that the same process and product applies. So what we try to do is, in order to make sure that application security architects can work with that DevOps process and reduce overall overhead that exists in this whole transaction, we try and integrate into native tooling across the SDLC. Now, the way Synopsys and we look at it is, we try and identify what control points exist within your SDLC. Majorly, we have the IDE, we have the build package manager step, we have the CI process, we have binary repositories. We identify different control points as they make sense to our customers, and then we recommend which of our plugins and native capabilities make a lot more sense. So CI as a control point is really, really popular. When companies are trying to move away from waterfall and be more agile, the CI step is pitched as the number one thing they need to do. Enabling their developers, empowering the developers, more so in these bigger organizations that have over 25,000 developers on file, it's really difficult. So being able to slowly and meticulously first understand what maturity level from a DevOps standpoint exists there, then ensuring that they understand, all right, this is the goal. They want to embed application security across their SDLC. What type of tooling, what type of plugin should be used? That's how we work with our customers and try to recommend what can be done.
But let's decompose this a little. If I look at software dev, and I've been doing it a few years now, developers don't set out to write bad code. They don't set out to put bugs in there to catch people out or to cause an organization to lose data. They have processes where they check code in, and in that checking process for most organizations, unit tests run at that point in time. This is a message we have been carrying for 2+ decades at the very least. What hasn't happened is we haven't seen that additional side of security, so that operational side of security, attacks that the company sees, be formulated into test plans against which software can be tested. How do we, first of all, start to look at what we need to add to our testing? And secondly, how do we persuade everybody that this is not an intrusive process, but actually can be fully automated, just sat in there and be effective?
Great point, Ian. I think that's a great observation. To answer that question, I think it's a combination of product and process that helps us deliver that message correctly. No developer is intentionally trying to build insecure code. It just happens as part of their development programming efforts, they do realize there's some loophole, be it from a quality standpoint or from a security standpoint, that they did not factor in before they checked in code. Now, as an application security architect who's responsible to make sure the integrity of the code base exists across the SDLC, and even if something gets identified, let's say way right of the SDLC, it's too expensive to go back and fix it. You have delivery timelines, you have a lot of other challenges that you need to meet. So in that scenario, what they want to do is they want to nip it in the bud by identifying it early on in the process. That's what they want to do, but they don't know how they can do it. So they rely on a lot of application security vendors to help them do that. A process around how this can be administered, plus a product that makes it easier for developers to not focus on what they call as this red tape sort of situation where you have a lot of processes and, oh, I need to go for quality checks and security checks, but actually focus on just doing what they have to do, which is programming, building secure code faster. The product processes run in the background, and they will ensure that everything that needs to be orchestrated before the code gets checked in is done in a seamless manner.
But the key here is seamless. I've sat with product teams who've had an overnight build. As they get towards the middle end of a project, everybody sits around the following morning, they quickly go through the build, they work out what needs to be fixed. One of the challenges, though, of this is that we don't quite know whose code went wrong. What we know is that the build failed, and we don't know why the build failed. And decomposing it earlier in the cycle, which saves us time, the whole shift left approach, makes sense. But shifting left comes with some other challenges to an organization, not least from a developer's perspective of, is it really going to pick up that mistake in my code, or is it only going to pick it up when it's done the compilation? How do we ensure that the process really has taken on the shift left?
In that situation, what we typically recommend our customers do is have these hooks available at some of the main control points. I'll give you an example. You have necessary tooling and process at the IDE level. So developers, they're done programming. Before they check in their code into source control, they are running these background processes, these scans, to make sure that whatever changes they've made or whatever code they've built, it's in compliance with the company's policies, A. It's not introducing any quality or security defect. And so all of that thing gets checked in automatically. When you check it in, source control understands your pull request, triggers a build. At the build CI level, where these pull requests are getting aggregated, you have a CI plugin that is ensuring and trying to complement the results you've gotten from the IDE. Because in theory, before you check in code, your issue counts should be zero. So your central analysis through your CI should also give you an issue count of zero. Unless something majorly changes between the IDE and the CI, there should also be a feedback loop. Because it's the developer who's managing it, if there's something on the CI that gets picked up, or there was a third-party dependency that got pulled in and got executed, and turns out it's violating a policy, there has to be a mechanism where that issue hooks into the bug tracking system of the organization and automatically gets assigned to the dev manager or the dev person who's responsible for that process.
How do we begin to pick up those third-party issues? We're in a world where digital transformation is causing us to use a lot of code from our partners. Our partners are using code from us. And that's not just our suppliers, but that's our customers as well. We're trying to speed up all of this and use software to do it. What we don't have access to is often the source code that they use. So we can't do some of this testing. We have to take on trust a binary that we're given or an API link that we hook to. Getting that level of trust is very difficult in that scenario. If we were thinking about a threat hunting scenario, it's slightly different. We have a lot of information coming in. What's missing in that commercial relationship?
Typically, I think the challenge, and we've seen this in the market as well, in the case of vendor-supplier sort of a relationship, if the supplier is obligated to supply the binaries to the vendor does not know if the binaries that were supplied, do they comply with license compliance laws, let's say, in the West? Let's say it was developed in some other part of the world where it was okay, but it's not okay here. How do you check for all of that? So there are mechanisms available. First up that comes to mind is Linux Foundation's SPDX format. SPDX is a very, very recognized format where it lists all the package information with the declared license, with all the other annotations specific to that package. A product like Black Duck, where we can essentially map the SPDX file to a specific bill of material to identify and let the vendor know, okay, your supplier XYZ sitting in this country gave you this binary, and this binary is made up of these components. So the vendor now has visibility without having to get access to the source to see, all right, what components are coming in, what security risk does it have, what legal risk does it have, etc.
One of the things that DevOps is designed to do is to accelerate our development. One of the challenges we've had for at least 15 years is the size of the manifests, of the number of components inside software is not tens or hundreds or thousands, it's hundreds of thousands or even millions of components. That means that when we discover that one component is faulty, we often cannot track that across the organization. DevOps at the moment doesn't integrate well into systems that give us that really detailed look across all components so that we can quickly identify that component used in a wide range of places. How do we start to extend DevOps to give us that better look at what's out there? Because that is all about velocity, change, and accuracy.
An example that comes to mind around this is being able to leverage and provide the developer. Let's not treat this as a security tool or a quality assessment tool. It's more of a productivity tool where we recommend the user some refactoring techniques. If there is some way to encapsulate everything in one file and then just reference it across, it's an easier methodology. For DevOps specifically, if there is an inherent component that is violating or causing concern across multiple sets of files, we now have access to hooking it up through your your CI process and ensuring that this parent system like Coverity or Black Duck, whatever system you're using, is able to trace down what the component is and what projects is it affecting. And then you have guided remediation methodologies available. How do you fix it? Do we need to upgrade the component? Oftentimes in the open source world, it's easier to upgrade than to fix the vulnerability, because if you just, let's say, going from Apache Tomcat 7.0.12 to 7.1, it's an easier change in your build configuration file to make instead of going through the entire list of vulnerabilities and fixing them. Providing that insight and providing the user the actionable insight around how this needs to be fixed once it's flagged is what is changing, it's coming up. Because all this while, middle of the 1980s up until early 2000s, identifying issues was a challenge. That has been solved now. The next logical step is, how do you remediate that? That is what companies like Synopsys is trying to do.
We've been talking so far about DevOps, and we've been looking about how this affects the large IT development and operations teams in an organization. The reality at the moment is that we're being told that everybody in the organization will become a developer. They'll be writing code, they'll be assembling objects, they'll be putting stuff together. But many of these people have got no relationship to DevOps. They don't know what DevOps is. They don't know how they engage with that. They don't know if they're building something that somebody three desks away is trying to create themselves. What do we do to democratize DevOps? Because if we want to democratize software development, we have to democratize the function below it, and that's the process.
And that's actually true, because even DevOps is built on the Agile methodology. Agile as a technique needs to be embraced across your organization. A more training and more awareness around how Agile works, how it's going to help us ship software faster, is the first step in the process. And then how the handoff that typically happens between development and operations can be made more seamless. Because oftentimes, and you see this countless number of times, developers say they've code frozen this specific project, they hand it over to ops. Ops finds something that was like, I don't know what's happening, it's not something we introduce, and there's this big crossfire happening. And so trying to have quantifiable evidence and processes and products that can help you identify and assign it to the right person is really important. And again, it goes back to my earlier comment, the tools and processes help you do that, as opposed to pointing fingers, oh, it's Mr. Developer 123 who made the change, not 456, and there's this whole confusion that goes on from there. Having these products essentially make it a much more automated way for people to identify who introduced this change, who introduced this problem, how can you fix it, and being able to provide that quantifiable metric that says, okay, when you checked it in, everything was okay, but somehow you introduced a third-party component, and that is what's causing a violation, Mr. Developer.
But that, again, is great if we're talking about a developer team. When it's somebody sitting in an office who's put this together at home, brought it in, and they're using it, then the person next to them think that's cool, they want to use it, then the whole office wants to use it. We've been around this loop since the early 1990s, when people started writing macros, and then suddenly IT had to get involved and make it an enterprise-stable piece of code. The identification, the service desk process we have when we have a bug for allocation and remediation, again, it's focused on IT, operations, security teams, and that function in the organization. It is not designed to operate with citizen developers writing bits of code and throwing it in. What do we do to encompass this era that we're moving into where everybody is supposed to become a developer?
In that situation, being able to have these ancillary functions, these people on the side who are actually developing code, separate from the process that's been put in place, what they can do is try and mimic what the process exists. I see that as a challenge in big IT enterprises. What typically happens is, again, goes back to my earlier comment, products and processes are able to identify any deviations. If some change was orchestrated and it does not follow the processes that are set up, it's going to fail the build, as an example, knowing that, okay, you know what, as a process, you did not check in with our factory team, for example, to use a third-party open source library. You did not even go through the due diligence and you just introduced it. You checked in your code. But organizations these days now have tools to help them gatekeep this so that it doesn't graduate into processes downstream. So you do have these gatekeeping options, be it at the IDE level, when they're actually putting in a pull request into their source control, or at the CI level, where you have everything aggregating together and you have identifiers and markers that tell you, okay, this is coming in from this dev organization versus these set of users who are not traditional developers.
Those traditional developers and those non-traditional developers all have the tools they want to use themselves. DevOps doesn't tell you what tools you should use. It simply provides you with a means to make things to happen. How do we now widen it to cope with the non-traditional developer? Because again, we've been kind of dancing around this in the last few questions and answers. What we haven't really addressed is we need to absorb those tools that they're using. The framework has to say, okay, this person's gone home and they've got a copy of Visual Studio at home and they've written this. But by the time they get to the office, what it is it an executable that they're just going to run on their machine? Therefore, I don't have any of the processes for integration. They're just going to drop it onto me. So how do I get the users to say, it doesn't matter whether you write at home, we can make this really simple and give you the same security, quality, safety metrics that we give developers?
In that situation, there's going to be some overhead for the application security team and more so for the, as an example, the build integration team, because this is not complying with their norms. This is, I would say, an alien change. And so when that happens, they have to go back and educate those set of non-traditional users on what the process is. DevOps gives you the framework to do that through ticketing mechanisms and this whole end-to-end process. In those scenarios, there's going to be some more back and forth between these people. There's still no solution out there that can essentially translate these ad hoc changes into a more seamless process. DevOps is a good starting point to at least get that framework in place so that the recipients of those changes know who to go back to and communicate and make it a much more seamless process.
One of the things we've heard at DevOps World this year is KK talk about Jenkins Evergreen. 5 steps and you're up and running, irrespective of who you are, whether you're a citizen developer or more serious developer. Do you think that has a play in fixing this?
Jenkins Evergreen is related to enabling Jenkins users to not have to worry about updating their version or updating their plugins, essentially. For the broader set of the audience, more so the build engineering teams, sometimes they have a distributed Jenkins environment and it's really, really challenging to update and manage that entire maintenance schedule. With Evergreen, it's easier to deploy Jenkins in these smaller node environments and just spin them up in a matter of seconds. It's helping get more adoption and more acceptance for Jenkins. It might help in the long run, but I'm not 100% sure for the use case, the problem that you sort of asked about in the previous question, the Evergreen scenario is really going to help there.
That's cool. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next year or two. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ian. It was a pleasure talking to you.